Crawford County case. Saint versus Keith. Counsel for both sides being present. Each side will have 15 minutes. Is counsel for the appellant ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
We have that Rachel Troutman is going to argue today. You don't appear to be Rachel Troutman.
Well, and thank you so much for noticing, Your Honor. Zach Swisher on behalf of the appellant for the argument today, Your Honor.
Very well. You have 15 minutes. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Zachary Swisher on behalf of Mr. Kevin Keith, along with my co-counsels, Jim Petro, Rachel Troutman, and Jim Woolley. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Try to remind you at that point, but the ultimate duty to keep track of the time will be yours.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Kevin Keith is an innocent man, and Michelle Yezzo's testimony was critical, essential, and material in Kevin's conviction. The trial prosecutor's belief of the materiality of Ms. Yezzo's testimony is clear from the fact that the trial prosecutor went to great lengths to secure Ms. Yezzo's deposition testimony for purposes of Mr. Keith's trial. As this court would know, that is an extremely rare circumstance for a trial prosecutor to go through the effort of deposing a witness for purposes of a criminal trial. And that's because the Rule 15 of the Criminal Rules of Procedure specifically state and has two elements in order to allow a deposition in a criminal trial. One is that that witness is unavailable. Two, and more important for the argument before the court today, is that that testimony must be material. So the trial prosecutor, in order to even depose Ms. Yezzo for purposes of the initial trial, had to have a finding initially that her testimony, again, was material. What we now know, and what Mr. Keith's counsel could not have known at the time of trial, but what BCI did know, who was Ms. Yezzo's employer, and I will use these quotes from her personnel file. The consensus is that Michelle's perceived problems affects her overall performance. Her findings and conclusions regarding evidence may be suspect. She will stretch the truth to satisfy a department. I'm not sure if a more damaging quote could be attributed to a forensic expert who's testifying at a death penalty trial. The feelings and attitude are shared by all of the labs, not merely London. Another quote, she has a reputation of giving answers at apartment once if they stroke her. Additionally, it is the consensus of opinion of the micro section that Michelle suffers a severe mental imbalance and needs immediate assistance. This final quote was actually in a memo from the assistant superintendent at BCI to the superintendent of BCI prior to Ms. Yezzo's deposition testimony being admitted in Mr. Keith's trial. The timing is very important. Obviously, this information that is before the court must have been in the possession of a state actor at the time of Mr. Keith's trial for there to be a Brady issue. That's significant because not only was Ms. Yezzo on leave at the time that she was deposed for Mr. Keith's trial, but in addition, there was a hearing scheduled to determine the extent of her discipline 2 weeks after she was deposed in Mr. Keith's trial. The state would ask this court to believe that any person could have come into court at the trial stage and testified as to the issues and the pieces of forensic evidence that Ms. Yezzo testified to. It's obvious that the trial prosecutor didn't think so. Again, given what I've stated as far as the lengths that the trial prosecutor went to in order to be able to depose Ms. Yezzo so her testimony could be admitted.
Well, counsel, let me ask a couple of questions about two different aspects. The first one, let's start with her actual testimony in the trial in terms of what that was. And I'm wondering if her testimony, as I look at some of the highlights of that testimony, it strikes me that that testimony in many ways was more favorable to the defense than the state in a way. I mean, she testified that this license plate issue, 043, was something that could have been common to many, many vehicles. So here the defense is in the position of having the state's expert testify to some of these things. She also testified that there was no fiber evidence linking Mr. Keith to the situation. She testified that the tread pattern that was found at the scene was only similar to the one that was in the brochure that they thought had been linked to the tires that may have been on the vehicle at the time, not identical. And then she also testified that, in fact, I think a footprint or some kind of print at the scene was absolutely not the same as shoes that had been recovered later from the defendant. So that's pretty good. I mean, that's a pretty favorable situation for any defense counsel, isn't it, to have a state expert, not an expert of their own, but even the state's expert, testifying to those things. So how was Ms. Yezzo's testimony actually even prejudicial to Mr. Keith? I mean, aside from these other issues about what coworkers had said about her and so forth.
So, Your Honor, in terms of Ms. Yezzo's testimony at the trial, so her testimony regarding the tire treads, so the only forensic evidence that placed those tire treads and that car at the scene was Ms. Yezzo's testimony. Regarding the license plate, it's kind of a twofold issue. The first issue is that the testimony at trial, that 043, was narrowed down to two cars in the area, one being the one that was in the possession of Mr. Keith's girlfriend at the time, and the other one that was in the possession of another alternative suspect. And that testimony regarding that license plate is not just about the numbers, it's about the numbers as well as the orientation and the position of that license plate on that vehicle. Because what that did is it then excluded any other potential witness, or excuse me, it excluded any other potential suspect who actually was Mr. Melton, who was at the time was another suspect in the case. It excluded him altogether. So it focused not only the police, but it focused the jury onto Kevin Keith regarding that car.
Well, we haven't even talked about the context in which you had eyewitness testimony from two people that it was Kevin Keith, but let's just focus on the car itself. It seems to me that she's laid out four very significant reasonable doubts in her testimony. So you have a state's expert that has set forth four very significant reasonable doubts to the jury. So I'm just still kind of wondering, in terms of the impact of her testimony, how it was that you could get to the level where you say, well, this was completely outcome determinative in favor of the state by having her at the trial. And therefore, that seems to me to be what you need in order to open the door then to say, and therefore, we should have been able to impeach her with this other stuff.
I think, Your Honor, the impact of Michelle Yezzo's testimony, and if you go back and look at the trial prosecutor's closing argument, is initially the first piece of information that's out of the trial prosecutor's mouth was about the significance of that car. The other significant piece of the trial prosecutor's closing is that, although he referenced, you know, the eyewitnesses that Your Honor discussed, he asked the jury to believe those eyewitnesses based on Ms. Yezzo's testimony. It was her testimony that he kind of called as fact.
Well, the victim that was injured in the apartment survived and absolutely identified him. It didn't have anything to do with Michelle Yezzo's testimony, did it?
Well, Your Honor, the transcript would show that witness who survived actually on four occasions did not identify Mr. Keith.
Well,
and said he was wearing a mask.
What does that have to do with Michelle Yezzo? I mean, there was no connection whatsoever between weighing that witness's testimony and anything to do with Michelle Yezzo.
I would say that they are based on each other. I think that, Your Honor, that the testimony regarding Ms. Yezzo's forensics placed Kevin Keith at that scene, and the reason that the jury should have believed a witness who couldn't identify someone four times, said they were wearing a mask, the reason that the jury should believe that eyewitness is not because of the credibility of that eyewitness. It's because, well, he's saying it, he thinks it's Kevin Keith, but we know that Michelle Yezzo puts Kevin Keith's car at the scene. We know that. That's Michelle Yezzo. So you should believe this eyewitness over here because of that.
Let me ask about the caliber and quality then of this other information. Could you fill me in a little bit on the these opinions and these quotations you cited, as I understand it, were recitations from coworkers, not conclusions of an investigatory disciplinary adjudication of some kind internally. So you seem to imply that there was such an investigation that had been initiated or was ongoing that might have led to the interview of these coworkers, but could you fill me in on what the context was exactly of those earlier statements that you quoted from?
Our understanding from the public records request of what was turned over from BCI is that there were a number of issues by coworkers, but in addition to supervisors, as well as the last quote that I read was a consensus in a committee. Was a consensus from a committee of supervisors regarding that.
What was the evidence that we have on this, or that you're pointing us to? Was there an ongoing investigation which had led to the interview of these witnesses and was somehow in progress or pending or had been concluded? Or what was the context these statements came from?
Our understanding from what we can glean from the public records request is that based on these issues, Ms. Yezzo was placed on administrative leave, and then an investigation to further, she was then disciplined, and then there was this hearing that I suggested was to take place 2 weeks after Mr. Keith's trial.
Were any of these statements that you quoted conclusions of supervisors that were reached based upon their investigation? Or were they simply opinions of coworkers?
They were not just opinions of coworkers. These were her supervisors. One of the quotes is from the assistant superintendent of BCI.
It appeared to me as though he were quoting the coworkers. He's saying, well, here's what I found in talking to the coworkers. They've said this, they've said that, they said something else. It didn't sound to me like he was saying, it's my determination that these things happened. Is that accurate or not?
I believe, Your Honor, if the assistant superintendent of BCI is putting a memo together to the superintendent that he has reviewed those conclusions and he would in order to forward that information on to the superintendent of BCI.
Well, I'm a little concerned about how far we go with this in terms of statements of coworkers. I mean, if counsel's coworkers decide over some period of time that counsel hasn't done the best job or so forth, is that something admissible or grounds for ineffective counsel? Or if this were a defense expert and the state were trying to introduce opinions of their coworkers at the trial that were negative about that person that had not yet reached any kind of formal adjudicatory status, would you say all of that would be admissible in any trial? How far do we go with this?
Well, Your Honor, I think that...
And even assuming we would decide that that's something that's relevant, what's your position as to how that comes into a trial?
Well, Your Honor, I think, and even pointing to the state's brief, that they acknowledge that the information in Ms. Yezzo's file is undoubtedly impeachment evidence. They've acknowledged that in their brief. And I think the answer to your question is how far you go is it's not the fact that Ms. Yezzo had something in her personnel file that was a derogatory comment from her coworkers. The comments in her personnel file directly go to her reputation and her credibility for being truthful in her testimony about forensic evidence.
But it's still just the opinions of coworkers, isn't it, about that? I mean, it hasn't reached any adjudicatory process or a hearing officer or a supervisor that says, based on these, I've weighed them, I've investigated them, I've determined the credibility of these statements, and I find them to be true. I mean, we don't have anything that's at that level, do we, in this record?
Well, I guess I would state, Your Honor, that, and again, I guess going back to my opinion, that if the superintendent of BCI or the assistant superintendent is pushing this through the chain of command, as to some sort of finding that this is an issue for them, but additionally, and the Brady doesn't necessarily require that finding. There isn't anything in the law that requires the impeachment evidence to somehow be adjudicatory or conclusory. I think that there is a kind of a critical mass of information in her personnel file that Mr. Keith's trial counsel did not have access to that undoubtedly would have allowed him to cross-examine Ms. Yezzo regarding her credibility and her reputation for truthfulness. as far as her testimony.
I have one other question. Is it your position that the state had some specific alert, notification, reason to have known or discovered this information prior to trial, or is it your position that simply they're the state, they're the prosecution, they're part of the system, they're part of the chain of command? Whether they had actual notice or not is irrelevant. They're responsible. Which one of those two are you urging in this court to establish as the standard for whether this should have been disclosed by them or not?
Well, if I may, there's obvious the general answer to your question, Your Honor, is that, you know, the BCI was acting as a state agent in this case. They employed the primary and the only forensic examiner. And therefore, that information and what they have in their possession, according to Brady, is imputed on the prosecutor. But more importantly, to your question as to this specific case, is contemporaneous with when she was deposed for Mr. Keith's trial, there was a hearing scheduled to determine some of these very issues. So the BCI had to have the information in their possession. Like, that's unquestionable. It was in their possession. They were having a hearing 2 weeks later, and they allowed her to testify.
So you're saying,
given what's in her file,
it's in BCI's possession, and therefore it's imputed to the prosecution.
That is.
You're not alleging any actual red flags, notice, or anything on the part of the prosecution.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Everything that we have gleaned, I think, from our review of the file would show that this trial prosecutor did everything by the book. That this was not in his possession at the time. And in fact, it is our belief that given some of the lengths that the trial prosecutor went to in order to make sure that the appropriate evidence was actually put on for purposes of the case, that if this information would have been in his possession, he may not have even attempted to call Michelle Yezzo as a witness.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.